brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Well, Carol, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast. I've been trying to do this for a few years now, so I'm really glad that you could join me today.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's been not uneventful for you these past few years. That's something we could, of course, dig into. Yeah. But I mean,
that's an understatement.
Just to give you a bit of background, I mean, I've potentially told you this by email before, but when I got back into the hobby in 2000, and it was either 18 or 19, and Open Combat was really the first game that I came across that was like a non-Games Workshop game,
right?
That kind of introduced me to this concept that, like, you could have small-scale miniature agnostic games. I think the fact as well that it came in this beautiful book, like that was, you know, if the first game like that I'd experienced was just like somebody's PDF made on Microsoft Word, it might have been a bit underwhelming, but just getting this fantastic book, and I really like, it really pulled me into that way of gaming. So thank you first and foremost for putting that game together.
Thank you for supporting it. You know, the miniature agnostic thing you mentioned, it's something that it's become kind of a thing now. There is a lot of it. Now, arguably, historically, it was always miniature agnostic, historical miniature gaming. So the rules would be written by whoever, and you just grab whatever figures you could get, whether it was the old, or really way back in the, you know, 60s, 70s, all those kind of figures they had then, all the way through. So historical gaming's always been arguably miniatures agnostic. Fantasy and science fiction gaming, that's a little bit kind of iffy, kind of where do you go from, what background have you got in that kind of gaming? Because obviously pre-Games Workshop, there was a lot of role-playing games and people used models for that, and you could get those models from anywhere. But then as Games Workshop, Citadel, I mean, the two were separate entities for a little while, but with the beginnings of that moving from role-playing support through to their own war game like Warhammer, you then had rules and miniatures starting to get bolted together. And, you know, you can't miss the fact that Games Workshop have become this giant machine that lots of smaller companies emulate. But from my perspective, when writing Open Combat, because of the nature of the hobby, you end up with vast collections of models, whether it's from board games, where you get loads of plastic in a lot of board games now, or whether you just like collecting miniatures. So I wanted a rule set that allowed me to just use whatever and stack them up in any way I wanted as well. So you weren't restricted by this is the army list. You could just use your imagination and create what you wanted. So I'm glad that kind of hit the right spot for you. Production-wise, my background is graphic design. So I worked at Games Workshop back in the early 90s. I was in their studio, then worked in advertising and various places, freelance for a long time. So my perception of what I wanted to look at was very clear in my head, and the finish of the book that I wanted. And I did use Kickstarter back in 2014, I think it was. Interestingly, it did start off as a PDF. So it was a PDF. It was reasonably well-designed PDF, but it was a PDF when it started. And then I kind of accidentally started the Kickstarter. I was looking at it, because back then it was really early days of Kickstarter, I guess. And I was kind of looking at it thinking, oh, how do you set these things up? And it said, kind of preview it. And I clicked that. And I assumed when I clicked the next thing, it was going to go off to the Kickstarter team and be reviewed. But actually, I'd launched it. So it was a bit, oh, better start promoting this then very rapidly. So that's kind of the origins of the book, if you like, because I couldn't have afforded to get a book with that finish without actually having the support of backers, if you like, to pay for that print run. Mm. But that's how it became the book that you picked up.
Aye, that's a good wee sort of behind-the-scenes peek into how the game came to be then. I mean, you touched on, you know, your career at Games Workshop. Have you got a kind of whirlwind run through of that, you know, how it came about?
It was very, very short. Well, I say short. I was there about 2.5 years, I think. I started in 92, yeah, it was November 92-ish. I'd finished uni the previous summer, trying to get a job in design, graphic design. Everywhere was saying you need 2 years experience. So I went into the Games Workshop store, actually, in Stoke-on-Trent, and said, I'd like to apply for a job. And they were like, we haven't got any in the store at the moment. I was like, no, in studio. And they were like, you're joking. I was like, well, yeah, just, you know, where's the form? So I filled the form in the store, and they sent it off, and they said, you're not going to see anything. And it was just a speculative. There wasn't any jobs going. I literally just sent my CV in. Didn't hear anything at all. And then I got a call to go for an interview. I went for an interview, taking my university kind of portfolio, which is just a uni student's portfolio, which years later, with all the experience I've got, you look at a uni student's portfolio and you think, this guy's going to take ages to train off. You know, that's the way it works. But I had the interview and then didn't hear anything for a few months. And I just thought, yeah, there was nothing in it. And then I got the call and it was like, we'd like to bring you in on a probation period for 3 months, just to see how you get on. And I joined in their promo and packaging department, which was essentially the guys that do the box art and any of the promotional material. Back then, they used to do kind of multi-page A4 leaflets that appeared in things and all that kind of stuff. And that's what I got hired for. Worked in the office with... Well, Mike Mavey ended up being in the office with us as well. And interestingly, after the 3 months, and they said, yeah, you've got the job properly, I had to ask them if I still had the job because I was commuting at the time to Nottingham. And they were like, what do you mean? And I was like, this is probation period. I don't know whether I've got the job properly. And they were like, oh, no, that's all fine. And it was like, so I had to move to Nottingham at that point because it was costing a fortune and taking so much time to commute backwards and forwards. So at the time, it was like, well, where am I going to live? And ended up getting a place with Mike Mavey because they were looking for an extra person to share with them. So I shared a house with Mike Mavey and one of the artists from the late 80s, a guy called Steve Tappin. So I was with two of the people I just thought were amazing in the hobby, just sharing a house all of a sudden and working at Games Workshop and being a fan of the games. It was amazing in itself. And I think that's partially why I got the game, because I got the job because I knew their game systems. And already being in design, even though at the time back then, it was a paste-up environment. So very much traditional. You do the artwork with overlays and you send it off to the printers and they do all the kind of reprographic element. So when I started, it was kind of traditional morphing into the Mac kind of digital kind of workplace. So I started off there, did that, did a bit of playtesting on second ed 40K, which again was one of those things where all the staff that worked in the studio, it was kind of a big kind of melting pot of ideas. So the designers, the art workers, the artists, the sculptors, they were all kind of all together. And the kitchen was kind of, you know, there were all concept sketches everywhere and all that kind of stuff. And then rules that were being discussed. It was a whole kind of collective mass of ideas that was swirling around a lot. So everybody got to playtest. So I got to playtest on that. Still, I was in production role. That was my role. I wasn't writing. And then when... the third edition of Blood Bowl was then the thing that was going to be developed. And I was a really big Blood Bowl fan. And interestingly, when I was younger, probably, when would it be? Wherever the first ed Blood Bowl came out, me and my brothers played it a lot. And back then, White Dwarf had got Andy Chambers and Jervis Johnson always playing against each other and Jervis being beaten by Andy all the time. And I said to my brother, one day, I'll beat Jervis in White Dwarf at Blood Bowl. And it was just one of those stupid things you say when you're a kid. But fast forward a lot of years later, I was involved in the development, playtesting of Blood Bowl. Got quite heavily into it. Got beaten absolutely every single game in the early iterations of the third edition. But then in the later iterations of it, I got quite good at it. And then and a lot of the kind of ideas that I threw in found their way into the game as well. So when it was released, Robin Dews was the editor of White Dwarf back then. And I said, it'd be really good to have a tactics article for this because it would support it on release. And he was like, well, write it then. I hadn't written anything for Games Workshop at this point. It was like, oh, okay. So I put together the first tactics article for Blood Bowl, the Orcs, how to play Orcs in Blood Bowl article, which was really well received. And then off the back of that, there was lots of other tactics articles for Blood Bowl teams that came out. And during that time, I think Necromunda started to be developed then and I was playtesting that. But all while that was going on, And I was really interested in writing. That was the other thing. I started to get more interested in writing. But there was no roles for that. And just from a point of view of home life and things like that, I was thinking I could really do with earning a bit more. And I knew guys that were working in advertising, and the rate that you earn for advertising as a designer or, you know, an art worker or whatever was higher. So it became a financial decision to leave. If I didn't have to financially leave, I'd have probably stayed there forever because I just loved it working there. But as it was, I left and popped back every now and again to play with them in the evenings, play test and things. But generally, I kind of diverged then, but I was still a hobbyist. I just wasn't working at Games Workshop anymore. So my period there was very much a production guy with a little bit of involvement in the kind of games development, but purely in a peripheral sense, except for when it came to writing a few things with Blood Bowl, because I did write a few other support things that were released in the Fnatic magazine, kind of follow-ons, the spikes and things like that, like the little leagues and various other little rules that became a thing and then spun off onto their own little series, if you like, that other people would see that first one and then jump off that and write a new little league for something else. So I kind of very often did things like just with an idea and then saw other people run with the idea. So it's one of those things that I've found throughout my career in different offices as well. I just try something because why not? Just give it a go and then it'll work. So other people will try it. And, you know, we all build on other people's shoulders. And arguably Blood Bowl is built on the shoulders of Jervis, because his original thing in Blood Bowl was based on a ratio, the way that the combat system worked. It was that kind of strength versus strength, and you work out how many dice you roll off the back of it. And that ratio aspect really clicked in my head as to how to develop a war game, like a skirmish game. Having a ratio between two sets of stat lines meant that you didn't have to worry about how the stat lines were created, because it was all ratio led. So if you gave people the option of building their own stat lines, because it was reflected on a ratio between the two stats, it didn't matter what they were doing. You couldn't go too big because it was only ever maxing out at, in open combat case, three dice. You only ever maxed out. So it kept it self-contained and self-balanced. So my kind of experience at Games Workshop kind of helped inform my own games development, if you like, later when it came to doing miniature games. Although I do play an awful lot of miniature games. I play a lot of different ones. So in that sense, I guess there's a lot of different rule sets that inform my kind of ideas. So I kind of diverged a bit there, but that's generally my experience at Games Workshop. It's quite small compared to others. I mean, I've known people like Gav Thorpe and people like that for years since, because he joined Games Workshop when I was there as a little assistant games developer. So it was, you know, it was his early days. And since then, we've stayed in touch and kind of play-tested each other's stuff. So,
yeah, I was going to mention that, because I know that Gav has, you know, he helped you out a bit, or if that's the right term, you know, Wotan Combat. And, you know, I've seen his name in the book as an acknowledgement and that. And I think it was, I think I heard you saying somewhere else, it was him who encouraged you to actually put pen to paper on those rules in the first place, wasn't it?
He did, that's right. Yeah, he did, because I tend to roll a lot of ideas around all the time for lots of different things. And it's a bit of a bad habit because finishing things is the difficult bit. That is the really difficult bit. It's actually stopping rolling the ideas around and then really nailing it down. And that was, there was, Gav was very much kind of, well, finish it then. So he was cracking a bit of a whip. And one of my other friends, Nick, he was also the same, is it finished yet kind of thing. So I had to finish it, and that was really hard, actually, because I naturally don't, I kind of veer off onto another thing and start developing that, because I like the development stage. I like that bit where you're throwing ideas in, but the actual, once you've got it working, I'm kind of done with it then. It's done. You've finished it, but you haven't, because then you've got to do all the production and all that kind of stuff and the presentation and writing in a way that makes sense to other people reading it cold. It's okay if you already know how to play it, because you can write it in a fairly shorthand way. Early iteration of open combat was two sides of A4. That's what it was, you know, because it just worked, but it had a lot of assumptions on the basis of if you already played games. So when it came to writing it up, I had to look at it as though I was someone coming to miniature gaming who didn't really understand it. But also, I had to acknowledge the fact there were a lot of miniature gamers that would be coming to it as a new, as a sort of try a different game. So I kind of had to write with the two minds in mind, like sort of thing. So the two kind of player bases. And I wanted it to be something that was easy for people to use. So 2x2 table, half a dozen figures each. You don't need a load of things. And time-wise, I wanted it to play quickly as well, because a lot of the time, you know, we're time poor. You know, we're so busy with stuff that finding the time to get stuff on the table and play is really tricky sometimes. So it's the game is built to be played quickly and in a small area, specifically because that is, it's a lot more accessible to people. But yeah, Gav did prod me a lot.
For the any listeners who aren't familiar with the game, I mean, it's fair to say, isn't it, that I'm saying it's fair to say, isn't it, you tell me, but the setting here is really either historical or sort of low fantasy. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, I think so. That's fair, because it's I intentionally didn't create a setting. Now, arguably, from a commercial point of view, that was not a great idea, because things like Frostgrave, for instance, they are arguably miniatures agnostic. They're not really, because they pump out loads of miniatures. You know, Osprey pumps out a lot of figures to support it. But the setting is incredibly well developed, and it has been obviously rather further over time as Joe's added more material. But the setting, indeed, it captures people's imagination. So you're pulled in through that. Mechanically, the game itself, all the rest of the stuff, that's almost immaterial because you're already bought in because of the setting. Whereas Open Combat's gone on the reverse side of it, in the sense that your setting isn't there. So yeah, fantasy, low fantasy, and historical is probably where it lives best, because it's low tech as well, and there's no magic in the main core system. So it's just purely guys with spears, axes, bows, you know, the armor is whatever you want to call it, because the way Open Combat rules work, you can choose to say, yeah, this guy's got heavy plate on, and you give him a high defense value, or it could be some sort of monster just with really hardened skin. They could have the same defense value, it doesn't matter. It's the interpretation you're putting on it. Mechanically, it works regardless how you kind of apply your intention, if you like, on the rules. The rules balance regardless, so it's up to you what you want them to represent. There are people who've used it as a basis to play sci-fi, which, you know, I can understand it working that way. It's not written with that intention. I do actually have a kind of rudimentary sci-fi version of it that's a long way off being finished, but there is that on the sort of back burner, if you like. But yeah, setting-wise, you're about right.
I want to ask you about the sword supplement. Is it Sword Masters?
Sword Masters,
sword,
yeah.
Masters. But just before that, I do notice in the book that you've got a lot of pictures and references to Romans versus, you know, yeah, Picts or Celts or that. Is that a period that interests you?
Yeah, I think the kind of that period, the period where people were toe-to-toe, that was how you fought, and it was primarily toe-to-toe as well. The missile weapon side of things wasn't really the big thing. So you had to literally get out there and fight it out. That's the period that I really like. I particularly like the Dark Ages, the sort of Viking period. Those kind of periods are where I kind of get drawn to. I do play, when Saga came out, I played that quite a lot, because I was using Anglo-Saxons at the time, Anglo-Danes, Anglo-Saxons. A friend of mine was using Vikings all the time. It was a period we both really enjoyed, so we played a lot of it. I've got Romans kicking around, I've got Celts kicking around. I like if you go further back, the kind of, you know, cavemen, Neanderthal kind of just playing with those sort of figures, fighting it. I know they don't fight with dinosaurs, but they, you know, chuck a few of them in anyway, where, you know, kind of get those old movies, old B movies. But, you know, that kind of it's pre-gunpowder, essentially, that kind of period before missile weapons really do take the fore. Now, arguably, you get to Agincourt, missile weapons are the thing. You know, you're firing hundreds and hundreds of arrows over. That sort of changes the face of warfare quite a lot, and obviously the introduction of black powder. But yeah, my favourite periods, or if I say periods, it's probably fighting style, actually. My favourite fighting style is that close-up, hand-to-hand side of things. And then wargaming off the back of that, whenever I've played with armies, I prefer the close-up, hand-to-hand armies, whatever it is, whether it's historical gaming or even science fiction gaming. You know, if we take it from a 40K sense, I like the armies that primarily get stuck in hand-to-hand rather than the ones that sit back and nuke them from miles away. And that's just, I think that's just my own sort of wanting to get stuck in on something rather than sit back and dial it in, if you like. Which, you know, it's good, but you do get a lot of bumps and bruises by having that attitude.
So what was the evolution into the Swordmasters supplement then? What did you feel was missing from the main game that you wanted to build on?
Yeah, when I wrote the original, like the core game is built to be as universal as possible, if you like. So everything there is open to as much interpretation from what you want it to represent without being too specific. So the rules are the rules, you know, there's no bending them. So you're not interpreting the rules, you're simply interpreting what each rule represents. So yes, you've got a hand weapon, it's a sword, for instance, but it could equally be an axe or something. It's just a hand weapon. So the rules for hand weapon are the same, regardless of whether it's a, you know, a really big club or a sword or an axe. Similarly, if you're playing with a monster creature, you could use the rule for hand weapon, and that is its claws or whatever it is. So that was the core system. That was the intent of that. So Swordmasters is where you start to get a little bit more specific. So if you're wanting to play with duelists or you know, some guys that, you know, they play with they fight with a left-handed dagger and a rapier or something like that, you do have to get specific at that point because you're creating rules for a specific type of fighting. So Swordmasters was essentially being a little bit more drilling down, if you like, and a little bit more specific within an open system. So the rules in it for the skills and abilities, you can apply them regardless of what your warband is, what your kind of model is supposed to represent. But some of them are very specific to using a sword. You know, whether you're parrying with the blade or you're kind of parry riposting, those kind of things, they get a little bit more specific there. And there's I think I referenced the sword breaker idea and things like that. There are rules in there for particular uses of a weapon. Now, I do mention in the Swordmaster supplement that you can, with the intent of open combat, you can apply your own sort of iteration of it if you want. So you can use the lunge rule to represent something else. As long as both players are, you know, aware of it. But from the point of view of drilling down a little bit or kind of becoming more specific, that's what the Swordmasters was. Now, interestingly, it was supposed to be a really small supplement, and it kind of expanded because it was the first one I did and I got a little bit carried away. I do have another one that I rediscovered, actually. I mean, it's something we've not touched on, but after I had the memory loss, I'd forgotten the things that I'd done. And I actually rediscovered while going through some of my old files when looking for catching myself back up on the Black Powder supplement that I'd written a little micro supplement for Barbarians, and it's really good. And it's a little micro one, so I've been sort of mentioning to Gav about it, and he remembered it. My wife even remembered it and said, you had that one ready to go. And it's like, oh, I'd completely forgotten it. But yeah, that one will probably appear as a PDF release because in the original intended size, nice and small and kind of bite-sized one, the Black Powder supplement will be happening later this year. I'm just getting back on top of that one. And again, like you mentioned about what was the intent of Swordmasters, Black Powder, it's a very different environment, warfare-wise. So it introduces different concepts, if you like, and different aspects of warfare that doesn't exist when you're just hitting each other with sticks, arguably. You know, it's that kind of adding in extra detail and more specific detail, which was better outside of the core rules. So yeah, essentially the supplements are supposed to add in more specific things, which do have a specific role, but you can, if you want to, put your own interpretation onto it. But the rules stay the same. The rules are all balanced regardless of what your interpretation is, of what they represent.
So you mentioned there with the memory loss thing, and I guess the listener's interest maybe peaked here, and I suppose it's a good time to ask you because I think these things are intertwined, but the game Lookrum as well, you know, with that coming about, and although it's not a miniature game, I think it's a game that'll be very interesting to the folks that listen to this show. So do you want to first just give us a wee brief synopsis of Lookrum, and then we'll dive into, you know, what actually happened in your life the last couple of years?
So, yeah, Lookrum's my first board game. It's a two-player board game, and rather similar to Open Combat. The reason I wrote it and created it was because I wanted a board game that was small, and it played on almost a coffee table level, like very small, in fact. It was portable, and a two-player game, and all the decision-making was on the players. There was no kind of random aspect to it at all, no dice. Everything was from the player's perspective, so it was two minds playing each other. And that was largely in reaction to the amount of big box games that take hours to play, because there are so many that you have to put aside an evening, like a big evening as well, like 4 or 5 hours to play it. And finding the players to play it, you know, you need a good 3 or 4 players to play it. And they're just massive games. Now, they are brilliant games to play, those sort of games. They're loads of fun and loads of depth. But I didn't want to write one of those. I wanted to write something that was a lot smaller and easier, so you could play it. If you went to a coffee shop, you could just get it out on the table and play it. And that was the kind of basis, if you like, of why I created it and how it developed. I think I'm not entirely sure. This is where the memory loss problem comes in. I'm not entirely sure why I went the way I did at the very beginning, although I do know that was the parameters I had to start off with. So, and I think I leaned into the medieval period as a theme and setting because naturally I like that period, you know, the Dark Ages period, then into the medieval, early medieval. I kind of like that period because it's when life was simpler, arguably. You know? And then from the point of view of the rules themselves, I didn't want it to just be a war game. That's what I didn't want it to be, where you just won by killing everything. Because games like that can quickly devolve into a one-sided affair. If you take enough of the enemy's pieces, you suddenly then, it kind of hits a kind of critical mass and you just wipe them. So the win conditions on it were a victory point based. I mean, it's gold in the terms of the game, but it's victory points. And the premise of the game, if you like, of Lookrum is that you are the current ruler of the land, the current king or queen, they've died. And then there are all the individual families kicking around, suddenly want to try and capture the throne for themselves. So yourself and your opponent both represent one of the heads of the families that think they've got a chance of taking the throne. You then start to manoeuvre to try and capture it. And by the nature of warfare back in the medieval period, it wasn't just a stand-up battle and you've got the crown. It was lots of political manoeuvring, having the correct terrain in place, having the money to bribe off other people who might try and usurp your position, all of that kind of thing. So the aim of the game was to get the money to be in a position of power so you win by having the most money. Now, you can get that money through claiming terrain places or just literally taxing the area, if you like, earning money from owning a region. And then there's combat as well. So if you take pieces, the money represents the giving, you know, the giving the nobles back, and then you getting the money for handing the nobles back, or whatever it is. So the game itself, that was the kind of theme, if you like, of it. And then mechanically, I wanted it so that when you're playing it, it's your choices that matter. So any combat moment or any moves or combats, you've got a restricted hand of action points, arguably, that you can use. And the turns, both players get the same amount of turns. Each turn has one player go first, obviously, but it alternates. So you get double turns. So you might go first this turn, but then you're going second next turn. So you take your turn, opponent takes their turn. Next round, your opponent goes first, so they get a double turn. But while that's happening, you're both going to benefit from that, and you've got a restricted amount of action points, arguably, these Lookrum tokens. And it's up to you whether you go hard defending yourself in your opponent's turn, or you hold back so that when you move, you can go hard yourself aggressively. So that, again, all the decision-making is on your own, in your own hands, and how you develop that strategy during the game. It's basically in real time. You know, you're looking at what's going on. You can see what your opponent's doing. You both In a combat situation, you're both blind. You're both blind to what your opponent's committing until you reveal them, and that way you can arguably bluff a little bit with how you're playing. But again, all of it is you versus your opponent. So you're playing. You're really playing your opponent, not the game, if you like. It's not the game that's going to win it. It's not some sort of random element that's going to win it. It's you and your decisions with your opponent. And that's the kind of games that I really like. I like those kind of very much kind of mind versus mind rather than who's going to roll the best kind of thing here on this particular moment. And then they go, oh, if you hadn't got that double six, you know, it's like it's kind of thrown it kind of thing. It's all strategy based then. So, yeah, I know that's a bit of a rattling, kind of weaving kind of overview of Lucrum, but, yeah, it's a board game. I think you get six turns, and it's up to you to earn the most gold to claim the throne. And it plays in about, well, I can play it in 20 minutes or, you know, it can play between 20 and 45 minutes, depending on how much thinking you do on your turn. But it's a lunch break game. You can play it in a lunch break, definitely. And on a, you know, it's an A5, like half an A4 size board, so it's really, really... small size, so it means you can play it anywhere.
I mean, from what I read on the big post that you'd put on your site, you had to rediscover this game, yes. And it was fortunate that you liked it. So talk us through the timeline here. I mean, yeah. you create the game, and then what happens?
Right, yeah. So I released it in June 22 at the UK Games Expo. And when I... came away from UK Games Expo, I got COVID, and I had it really mild. You know, it was quite mild. But then a month later, I had a massive memory loss, and whether it's related to COVID or not is completely up in the air. It probably isn't. But the memory loss was, I had a period of about a week where I kept losing my memory. So there was post-its all over the house saying you're having problems with your memory. Because every morning I'd wake up and I'd go, I had a really weird dream. I was losing my memory. And it was a real thing. So my family had to deal with this. And I was repeating myself every 10 minutes as well. So it'd be like, I just think I feel like I've lost something. And I'd say the same things every 10 minutes. So that occurred for about a week. And then when I went to the doctors, it kind of settled down where I wasn't losing my memory anymore. But I'd got a big gap, huge gap, of the previous 2 to 3 years. Now, since then, we've discovered actually my gap is a lot more kind of varied, and there's quite a lot that I've lost over the years. But it's not very specific either. It kind of jumps around. There's various pockets that I do know very clearly. So, for instance, the UK Games Expo, there's a few moments I remember very clearly from that actual previous Games Expo. But there are other aspects that are utterly blank. I see photos from that same period and I have no idea, but I'm in them. I don't even know what it was. But yes, over the next 6 months, I was trying to work, but I couldn't work because every time I tried to work, what felt like it was an anxiety attack occur. So I was getting these like 12 to 14 anxiety attacks a day, or rather that's what they thought they were at the time. And then eventually in January of 23, after several MRIs and my second EEG, they worked out, because at the time I was thinking about something I might work on that afternoon, like writing. And I had a little bit of a moment where the person running the EEG looked round and went, are you having an episode? And I was like, oh, it's only a little one. I could just feel the rush of anxiety starting. And she just nodded and looked away. And then that was it. I went home. That was it. Next day, I was driving back from dropping one of my boys off at school. And I had a call from the hospital where they said, come in. We need to talk about management. And I was like, oh, right. What's that about then? And I got in and they said, you've got epilepsy. And it was like, what? I never lose consciousness. I never fall over. I've got friends who've got epilepsy and they have it the full fit. And it's a particular type called focal epilepsy, which since then I've discovered does actually affect memory and can have an impact on memory. And my memory isn't great now. It's I do lose things like time and place. I do lose time and place. So I have to write things down. I don't lose things like I was doing back when it was first starting, which you think the theory is that I had a massive seizure back then in the summer of 22, which then had loads of rippling seizures thereafter until it settled down. Because when they actually diagnosed me, I hadn't had one for a long time. I hadn't had, well, what we now know as seizures, I hadn't had one for a long time. But off the back of that, I had to give my driving license back and all that kind of thing. But during that period, once everything settled down, I found Lucrum, and it was like, what's this then? And it was like, you wrote it. You created it. I was like, what? And I found the files on my computer. And everything was there. It got my name on it. And I was like, I have no idea what this is. Absolutely no idea. Because part of my memory loss, the big chunk of it, was the whole development period of Lucrum. So I've got all the photos of the little playtest bits and all this kind of stuff. And Gav telling me what we did. And I had no idea at all. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And there are stuff that I wrote for Open Combat that's not released yet that I'd forgotten about entirely. They're on my computer as well. It's like there's loads of things that I discovered. And I found a printout with a set of rules of a dice game that I actually sent it to my brother. I took photos of it and sent it to my brother and said, is this yours? Because he writes things every now and again. And he was like, no, that's yours. I've got the mock-up here. And he sent me a photograph of all these dice with kind of biroed on faces and things. He's like, this is really good. And he's like, yeah, you wrote it. We were talking about it. It's another game that I'd forgotten I'd done. So there's loads of things that I'd rediscovered. But on coming back to it and actually reading it, I was like, it was one of those kind of, I don't know, weird moments where you look at something completely clean. And as a creative, you don't normally get to have that experience of seeing something as though it's a brand new thing. So I'd written it, I'd created it. I had no idea I'd done that. But when I read it and had a little go of it, I was like, this is really good. So it's quite nice to know that I actually quite like the thing that I created. And I hadn't got that kind of face against the coal face kind of sense of it. It was just completely objective, which was quite nice. Quite encouraging as well that I actually thought, yeah, it's a good game. But yeah, very weird experience.
How was it for like your business during that time? Because I mean, you would be presumably having potential customers wanting to buy things. Yeah. That. Like, how did, I mean, were you aware enough to put anything in place?
That's been one of the hardest parts of it because at the time, fortunately, just before it had all happened, I'd been working at something out with a few other kind of businesses to try and partner a way of handing some of the work off. Part of the problem when you work for yourself, trying to do everything, and this is one of the mistakes I've made, and over the years, in hindsight, going forward, I'm going to change the way I kind of operate, is when you try to do everything yourself, so on my point of view, writing, photography, illustration, graphic design, all the rest of it, that's just one bit of the job, you know, and all of those are individually are really good, like are important roles in themselves. You've then got the sales roles, the kind of administration roles, the kind of finance roles, all that kind of stuff. There are loads of roles that whenever you work for yourself, you know, there's lots of people who do it. You do all of those roles, but it's very easy to burn yourself out. And I think I was on the edge of burnout when I eventually developed focal epilepsy. I think I must have been right close to the line. I'd been running close to the limit anyway for a while. And then because of it, I couldn't work. Luckily, I was in a position where other people could help me out. But I was then thinking going forward, once I started to pull things together and things were calming down, I needed to hand off the shipping aspect of it. So I think it was in the autumn that year, when my memory was starting to settle down, I got in touch with Sarissa Precision, who do MDF terrain and things. And I'd apparently already been talking to them about using them to do my shipping because during Brexit, everything changed with the VAT and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't want to have to handle shipping into other countries and handling the VAT with other countries. But Sarissa already had that set up. And Sarissa are the ones who were manufacturing Lucrum, so it allowed everything to stay in one place, if you like. So I went over to see them again, and we got all that organized. And currently, physical products ship from Sarissa. They ship the hardback, they ship of Open Combat, they ship Lucrum. So it takes that out of my hands. But from a business perspective, I wasn't writing. I couldn't write because every time I wrote, we now know that's what was causing the seizures. It's complex thinking, and according to the epilepsy team, stress is what is my trigger. but complex thinking is a form of stress. So it was like any kind of attempt at writing or thinking of kind of the what ifs that is games development, you know, you kind of what if ideas all over the place, it was triggering it. I'm medicated now, so everything works fine now, but at the time I couldn't operate. So I had to find myself another job, just a completely mentally sort of low level job. So I ended up working nights because the other factor was I had to give my driving license back due to epilepsy. So I had to hand the driving license back. I couldn't do trade shows off the back of that because I couldn't drive anywhere. So I took a job nights at a supermarket just to level myself out. So from October through to it's currently still a thing. I work nights in a supermarket. But now, since I was medicated and the medication got to full level that it needed to be, since last, so what is it? It's since summer of 23, my head's been back to level again. I've been kind of gradually allowing myself to get back into writing and working things out. So I am kind of coming back into it all now. But having that regular income of the part-time job means that I don't have to stress out too much about having to hit the ground running and get products, shifting a lot of product, you know, to make money, to earn the bills, to pay the bills and all that kind of stuff. So from a business perspective, it's almost like starting again, but starting from a position of actually having stuff already in the market with a good standing, if you like, because Open Combat's, you know, it's well received. People who play it do like it. And it has been selling while I've not been saying anything. You know, while I've not been on the online promoting it, it's still selling, regardless of whether I'm making noise or not. And I haven't been on the show circuit for a year, and it's still selling. So, you know, that's all good. Lucrum's not had the promotion that I needed because I've never really been loud about it. I launched it at UK Games Expo, but it's never had the out-and-out promotion of it. I've not been around trade shows with it. I've not really been loud with it. So that's still almost like something in its infancy that's not really taken off yet. It's out with a lot of reviewers. I've not chased any of them up because I gave it to them just before Christmas, I think. But I hadn't got a deadline for it because I wasn't running a Kickstarter. It's already out. But I will be following up on them because something that someone mentioned on Board Game Geek was, is there a print and play edition? And that's something that I hadn't really got around to putting together, but it's something I could quickly put together. And you can sell that quite cheaply as well. So print and play, I'll do a version of that. There is other aspects of Lucrum, so there's a multiplayer version that I want to do, but I won't do that the way I've done it already. I think I'll probably look at crowdfunding that. But before I did, I'd organise everything in place. Because when I did the Kickstarter for Open Combat, I did it all myself. And having had that experience, definitely share the workload. Don't try and do it yourself. I don't know what things are like now. Things are very different since 2014, but it's... doing everything yourself is too hard. It really is. It's just, it's hard and it's stressful. Now I've learned my lesson. 10 years on, I've learned my lesson. Share the workload, definitely. If any of your listeners are thinking about it, it's definitely share the workload. That's the biggest piece of advice I could give to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic example. You know, seeing yourself as a single point of failure, you know, like if you go down, yeah, the whole thing,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely, yeah.
But you know, talking about Lucrum there, and I, Sarissa, I think it was you said, printing and distributing it, and I was really pleased with the quality, you know, the wee bag and stuff. It's a great wee package. I don't do a lot of video stuff, but I did a wee video. But I was looking on there, you're right, there's almost no content about the game anywhere yet, because no. I do like to, you know, even if I ostensibly understand the rules, I do quite like to watch somebody having a wee game of it or a turn or two,
yeah.
And I couldn't find anything at all apart that's from right. on your own site, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that a few of the reviewers, there's one or two of them that do how to plays as well. They do those kind of videos, and they did say they were going to do those. The feedback I got, actually, the instant feedback I got when I sent them out, one guy, I think it was one of the French guys, said that the rules, from the rules point of view, he said it is incredibly elegant, and he could imagine him taking it with him as one of his travel games because it fits, you know, as you say, it's in a little bag, fits really easily in a suitcase with all your other stuff. It's really simple travel size. And then another guy got back to me, and he, from a production point of view, was like, wow, just seeing it, you know, it's physically, it's a lovely object, which for, as a graphic designer, that was kind of the intent, if you like. What I'm considering though going forward is whether my initial print run of it at this kind of the current sort of look of it that you've got, that may be a limited run. Keep it limited because it's quite labor intensive to produce, because you kind of have to handle everything to put it all together. And I think in the future, if I do a kind of a crowdfund based approach to doing a four player box sort of edition of it, or a bagged edition of it, I'm not quite sure how I'd present it with a four player edition, I'd take a different approach, mainly because it's got to be less labor intensive, because as you mentioned, if you're a single person, it's a single point of failure and everything falls down. So I need to share the load and make things more more sort of future proof, if you like, you know, so that things don't fall over with one or two people. It's one of those things that the other aspect of Lookrum is, as a system, it works as a it works as a board game, but as a system, the actual mechanics in it, they do lend themselves to miniature gaming on a board, if you like, with a grid. And I have got the rudimentary version of that for playing. Interestingly, earlier on you mentioned about the Celts and the Romans, but playing with Celts versus Romans, you can play it obviously medieval, so I have got the rudimentary version of that to play it as a war game, and it's the sort of thing I would take around war game shows to show people on a tabletop, because there are grid system war games, you know, there are To the Strongest, I think, is one of them. I played that one. There's several grid system war games that you can play, as opposed to the tape measure war games that we're all familiar with. Look, there's still a lot I can do with Lookrum aside from promoting the current edition, you know, the current first edition, because it's not, like you say, there's nothing about it anywhere, because I fell over basically just on launch, you know. It's kind of like my brain went and that was it. It's like the danger of being a one-man band if you're doing everything, you know, there's nothing, there is no safety net, which is why, you know, the having the part-time job helps, because it kind of cushions you from those sort of stressful situations where you're trying to run a business, but you not only you're doing all the running of the business, you're trying to make sure as the business is earning enough money to not only cover its overheads but also pay you a wage, kind of thing. So it's there's a lot of factors as a one-man band that if the one man falls over, it's quite severe.
The Bedroom Battlefields Patreon now comes with bonus content, the first of which is a full battle report from White Dwarf issue 166. I read through this iconic showdown from 1993 between Blood Angels General Andy Chambers and Orc Warboss Jervis Johnson as they showcase the new Warhammer 40,000 second edition. Find out more at patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. That's patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. And now back to the show. In terms of your job as well, like talking about, you know, going and working in the shop as opposed to, you know, presumably you were doing what you would class as knowledge work before.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, from my own point of view, like I used to basically cut grass for a living. And Nowadays I work at the computer all day. And as much as, you know, there's so many benefits to that, you know, come in the morning, put the heating on, put the coffee on and that. I do miss just going out there and doing a job that is muscle memory, because I felt very creative in that period. You know, I did a lot of fiction writing at that point, and I just going and doing a job, like I say, more physical, more rote, it puts your brain into this, like, you know, your subconscious just works away and you just come up with so much stuff. And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. 100% agree with that. The one The one thing I do think now over the last 18 months, because it is about 18 months I've been working it, it's working nights on a supermarket, it's handling these big 2-meter-high, 1-meter-square cages with full of product, getting out onto the shop floor and empty them basically onto the shelves. So it's essentially a shelf stacker job and pulling the stuff off the trucks and all that kind of stuff. So it's very manual, very, very manual. It's muscle stuff. It's not mental stuff at all. Which was perfect for when they didn't know what was going on with my head. You know, there was no strain on it or mentally. And since I've been medicated and everything sorted out there, exactly what you said, I can just be working away physically. I'm in my body, if you like, physically in my body. And I have lost a stone and a half working there. It's been brilliant. You know, suddenly got physically fit again after just wasting away sitting at a desk for years. But the, or rather muscle wasting away while sitting on the desk. The working physically gives your brain time on something that's not working your brain, gives you time to roll things around, roll the ideas around. And I started keeping a notebook February 23, because I got the date in the beginning of it. I had a look the other day. And that's now full of whether it's board game ideas, miniature game ideas, a few other things that I've got on the go. It's got loads of kind of conceptual stuff. Some of them are quite well developed, actually. There's a couple of games that are quite well developed in there now, which I did in my breaks. And then when I get home with a cup of tea or something, I'd carry on it. But they're all at that point where I could do with actually sitting down and doing some proper development work on it. And now with being medicated now, I can do the development work on it. But that whole period, or the having that physical role, does give you the brain space, if you like, to just bounce ideas around without staring at a screen, which is quite useful, you know. And that, I think that it's, as much as it's been a really difficult period, it's actually been a really useful period because it's got me back in my body, which has been really important, because it's very easy to kind of get lost when you just work. You know, you come in, stare at a screen, all in your head, and then you're never actually out of your head. You're constantly in your head. So I think having that physical role, as well as having the kind of mental work that I do separately, it's been really useful. And going forward, I mean, myself and my wife have been talking about it. It's probably better if I keep. I don't want to be on nights anymore because that's making it quite difficult now. That was purely because I didn't have a driving license. And I've got my driving license back now because I've been seizure-free for so long. So now I can sort of get a role somewhere on days. But I think I'd probably like to get a part-time role on days just so that we've got that kind of income coming in that's not reliant on me doing any sales or anything. And bearing in mind, stress might be one of my triggers. So getting a part-time physical role to then allow the rest of my time in the week to be doing the kind of creative work. I think exactly like you've said, having that physical aspect separate to your kind of mental work is really good. You know, I think I'd lost sight of how useful that was until being enforced to actually do it. You know, it's been a useful period despite the kind of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you coming on to kind of talk us through it, because it's a very unique, they say not unique to everyone in the world, there'll be other folks that have had it, but you know, it's not something I'd encountered before, so
yeah, it's a very unusual experience. I was told there's like 25 different types of epilepsy or something.
Yeah,
and there's a girl at work that's got it, and she has it a lot worse than me. She has the full fall over, lose track of time, everything. And I really do feel for her because she's 20 and she has it a hell of a lot worse than me. So I'm really lucky in that sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, I might not be unique in the sense that there's a lot of us who have it, but I think my experience from working for myself feels quite unique for me as a creative to suddenly see your own work completely objectively. You know, that's the unique aspect for me. It's like, wow, I wrote this, but I have no memory of it at all. You know?
Yeah, not many people have created a tabletop game and can't really remember creating it. So
yeah, it's very strange. I mean, Gav keeps saying to me, because I haven't played him since my memory sort of lost, but we keep saying we've got to get together because he never beat me while we were doing development. So he wants to play me while I haven't, before I remember how to play properly. You know? I mean, I do know how to play now. I had a little backwards and forwards email with one of the guys who's going to be reviewing it, because they're asking about using the you know, whether you get the pieces back on the board, if there's any way that you get the pieces back on the board when they've been killed in combat. I was like, no, no, you don't. You know, if they're lost, they're lost. But that then I sort of went on to say, if you go into Lookrum expecting to play it like a war game where you have a military approach and that's all you do, you will lose. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that's not how you win the crown. That's not how it works. You don't just win by killing these other people, because by then they've paid off all the other people around and you've got no, you know, it's like from a thematic point of view, it was like you can't just win through combat. That's not how it is. You know, back in the, you know, the Dark Ages period, raiding a village, yeah, you could win by just battering everybody in the village. But thinking of the medieval period, when you've got lords and landowners all over the place, yeah, you just put money in the right pockets and you've already won, you know. So getting the money's the key.
More about being it's been years since I watched Lord of the Rings, not Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones. Was it Varys, the baldy guy? Was that him? Was that his name?
I can't remember.
And the wee guy, was he Tyrion?
Ah, yeah.
So you're politician basically, more than just your brute.
Yeah, you've got to have the hammer as well. You know, you can't just be all nice. So you can get in there and do a bit of combat, but it's using it strategically. So only wielding the hammer when you need to, and being putting yourself in a position where you use that leverage, if you like, of your armed forces to kind of just push things into your kind of your benefit. So positionally in Lookrum, you can earn gold just by being in a particular square, and you can just use it to accumulate wealth. That's the actual term of the action. You accumulate wealth by having a piece somewhere, but you can't be in a square that is threatened by enemy pieces. So you could use combat to force enemy pieces away from a space so that you can accumulate wealth in multiple places. So in a sense, your use of military actions is affected by what else you're doing, and sometimes it's just purely to make a little bit of space so you can earn more money. You know, it might be to actually capture an objective, you know, capture a terrain feature or something, but there are occasions when you'll just use it just to ease slightly the positioning so that you've got more chance to get a higher income. So it's not just about battering the other person over the head and removing his pieces, because it's not going to win you every game at all. You know, I don't think I've ever played a game where I've used that technique and won it, like specifically won it through that technique. There's always other aspects of the game that you need to employ. And it's interesting watching people play, because one of the few things I do have as a memory from playtesting, which has come back from some of the photos actually that I've got from the playtest period, is watching the opening moves of a player and seeing how they are going the military route. And already you can see the gaps that are there for accumulating wealth, because they're over committing to one particular style of play, which opens the board up essentially for you to exploit. So it's that kind of strategic aspect of the game that was the intent when I wrote it. I do know that much. That was the intent, to make it so that your decisions are what win the game. You know, it's not the roll of the dice, if you like. I mean, obviously there are no dice in it, so it's purely based on your decisions and your opponent's decisions. And, you know, you can adjust. You know, you see what your opponent's doing, you can adjust in real time. That's the benefit of it. But again, it's that kind of bluff, double bluff kind of thing. And like when you're kind of in a combat situation, you've got a zero, a one, two, or three. So you can influence the combat with either adding a zero to the result or to one, two, or three. And sometimes you can just throw that zero in because you're not actually that bothered. You know, you're quite happy to just step away from the combat, you know, and retreat, because you might go heavy looking like you're intending to win that battle, and you force your opponent to play a high number, and you just then play your zero and you step back, and your opponents now use their higher number, so you know they don't have that number in their hand anymore. So when you go somewhere else, you can go in, you know, knowing that you're going to win that next combat. So it's that kind of bluff aspect of the combat system that comes out. But yeah. I'm going off on a random tangent again. I keep doing
it. No, it's good for me to hear, because I've got the game, so...
Yeah, don't try to play militarily, you won't win. use it as a lever.
Carl, it's been a brilliant conversation. I really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about your experiences and your games. Is there a good place for the listener to go to check your games out and keep up to date with things?
Yeah, if they go to secondthunder.com, that's the site. I am going to be, I mean, just probably in the next few months, I'll be splitting off the digital content onto its own PayHip site, mainly because of the way that the connected to my memory loss, the way that with Brexit and the way that VAT works in the EU and all those kind of things. I'd already set all of that up, but it's an aspect of the kind of business side that I don't want to have to carry anymore. So what I'm going to do is put digital content on a PayHip site, because PayHip handles all the kind of VAT and all that kind of stuff. So it'll essentially be secondthunder.com is where you go. You get all the physical stuff there. Currently, the digital stuff's there as well. But eventually there'll be a link through to my PayHip site, which will be a kind of Second Thunder Digital or something like that, domain name on it, where people can get digital content. But yeah, at the moment, secondthunder.com. Hopefully, next couple of months, I'll have Open Combat on Amazon. It's actually on, there is a listing on Amazon and it's got good reviews, because I did use their Fulfilled by Amazon way back when. I used to ship the books there and then they fulfilled it. But now print on demand and all that kind of stuff has happened. So what I'll probably do is get to, well, in fact, no, what I am going to do is get Open Combat on the Amazon print on demand system as well, so that people wherever they are could then order it through Amazon and get it print on demand. Mm. I've just got to reset the artwork for that, and get a few sample copies from them to just check everything's correct. And then that'll be live. So that'll be another thing. And that's largely, a kind of idea of doing that is largely thanks to Henry Hyde at Battle Games, because he'd been doing that for a while. He's a graphic designer, similar to myself, background. And I had a chat to him once my brain had come back together and he was explaining to me that's a good way of doing it. So I'm going to be doing that over the next couple of months as well. And, you know, Lucrum will be a print and play version as well over the next... I'm expecting that in the next month, actually. So I'll be getting onto that. It's on my to-do list, very high on my to-do list, in fact. Yeah.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.